Was it something we said?
Are you talking to me?
Do you have a comment to make?
Are you talking to me?
Or a bone to pick with us? Why not send us an email to feedback@midwestpeaceprocess.com or join our forum at forum.midwestpeaceprocess.com. Or you can just leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/midwestpeace, or follow us on Twitter @midwestpeace. So that's how to contact us. Now let's give you something to contact us about. This week, we turn our head and cough. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
to remind
process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 34. Today is June 28th, 2012. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob. Woo! Individual mandate, baby.
Oh. Individual tax. It's not a tax, but it's a tax, even though that's unconstitutional.
It doesn't matter, baby. It passed. It's in.
Okay, Mr. Pelosi.
Okay, so if you haven't guessed already, our topic tonight is health care. Supreme Court ruled today that what we all know and love as Obamacare is apparently constitutional in some respects. So we're going to spend a little time talking about that and what the implications might be for us and for the country.
Yeah, I'll only be able to contribute every 10 seconds or so because that's when I'll be coming around on my victory lap.
Wow.
Yeah, it...
No, we'll talk about it.
Well, you're hitting on a good point there, really, that this one issue, it's just been completely polarizing, and I don't understand that. At some fundamental level, it's like you either agree that this is a good idea or not. It really shouldn't matter, like, what party you belong to.
Right.
And yet it does. I mean, this is so totally, Democrats love it, Republicans hate it, and you better get in line or you're going to get run over.
I think it might be a little less partisan than that, I guess. I mean, I think there are, well, it's hard to say. I mean, you have the people who are single-payer folks on the left that are pretty upset about this because this pretty much knocks out any chance of that ever happening, or at least in the near future, I think. And yeah, I mean, your Republicans are going to hate it, but it does shine a big, big stinking light on where health costs are really coming from. I just like the fact that we were able to talk about it, and we're talking about it now. It's good. It's good for people to know where all this stuff is coming from or how health care is paid for.
Yeah.
I think it's a good conversation to have.
So do you think it's just become over-politicized because Romney's made it, this touchstone of the campaign? It's like...
I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts. I guess the one I'm not really cheering, and that really wasn't me going woo individual mandate. Just wanted to rub it into your guys' face a little bit. Yeah, so I don't really feel that, but I do feel. I guess the thing I'm happiest about is I think with this decision coming down from a maybe perhaps conservative-leaning court, or at least with Kagan recusing herself, I think it kind of undercuts the idea that the whole concept is, some kind of radical, un-American, impossible idea. I think it could be a very bad idea, totally open to the idea of it being a bad idea. But I think the case against the whole thing was that it was, some kind of awful alien idea from outer space that got brought into us by a bunch of commies, and I think now the idea, at least right or for wrong, has, you know, some scholars, some legal eight scholars thinking about it and at least saying that it's, you know, in the pattern of other laws. And so now what I feel like it's like it, what it opens up is now we can talk about it, you know, in a very simple case, like, is it a good idea? Does it seem to make sense? Which we completely lost throughout the whole debate. And I think
shouldn't we have talked about all that stuff before they passed it and made it law?
No, you got to pass it before you can read it.
That's become a big joke, but that's sad.
Yes,
it is sad.
It is making a joke out of the process of checks and balances and lawmaking.
Right. Well, I think what's kind of neat about the media buzzstorm right now is that it seems to be focused on this, on just the idea of the individual mandate, you know, like, because that's the one part that was kind of discussed today, plus the Medicare part. And so just if you boil down the discussion right to individual mandates and how they would work, then that's like a discussion that I think we can have. And that's where people can weigh in on. But I think the point, at least I'll just pick at the Republicans here. The point of the Republicans wasn't to have a discussion about the individual mandate when that was all happening. The point was to talk about death panels and scaries and rising taxes. And I mean, the point was to drum up fear about the whole issue. Well, now the issue's passed, and now we're talking about individual mandates. And I think people can actually talk about whether they think that's a good idea or not. So this sort of boils down the whole mess, at least into one part of the bill, which is good. Yeah. You guys hate the individual mandate.
There's a number of issues that I have with it. I mean,
let's hear it.
Well, I mean, the argument goes something like this: you have to have health care in order to live, and therefore, because you have a right to life, your right to health care is implied, and so we're going to, you know, let the government somehow help you facilitate that right or exercise that right by taxing everybody and paying for health care. And
right,
you know, and so I'm not trying to make any sort of commentary on the Supreme Court decision yet. I'm just saying that's, you know, that's kind of the argument, right, to justify this whole thing since we've been talking about it for the last 2 years. You know, my argument is simply that, okay, well, insert the word food where you have health care, and the same argument holds, right? I mean, so why aren't we talking about universal appetite care instead of universal health care? You know, like we should be, the government should be feeding everybody too, right? Because
they kind of are.
Yeah, doesn't that happen?
But
yeah,
they don't mandate it, and they don't tax you if you don't eat.
That's so. Because it's cheap. It's cheap to feed you.
Well, I'm just saying if we are saying that this is something that is necessary for life as a human being, you know, that this is a basic human right, and that you must have health care in order to live, the same can be said of food, water, shelter, clothing. So why aren't all of those things being provided by the government to everybody, and not just a small subset, because that, you know, that wouldn't be universal.
I think,
well, Jerry, that would be ridiculous to think the government would.
Well, so, okay, and you're right, and so my question is, are we ignoring that, you know, that logic, where that takes us, or is that, yes, in fact, where we're trying to go, this is just the first step in that direction? Is that the agenda, and has that been the agenda all along? We're trying to get to that, you know, socialist utopia where everybody gets everything paid for, and, you know.
I think it's because it's not obvious, or it's not as obvious, who doesn't have food. Like, there are people who beg for change so they can get a meal.
Right.
But it's not the same. It doesn't have the same impact. It's like, well, that's a homeless guy. You know, of course he's begging for food because he made some bad choices, or however he got to be homeless, he's begging for food. But there are people with steady jobs who don't have health care. So it's able to be politicized, and that's why it's health care and not food.
Well, and it's not just, I don't think it's not just that it's able to be politicized, it's just a big deal. And I think you maybe mischaracterizing what the case is for all of this is. I think to me the case is more that we're paying for it all anyway. We are paying for people who are receiving health care that aren't able to pay for it right now. And we have for who knows how long. That if somebody needs care and there's nobody to pay for it, that we're all paying for it anyway. Like, as I understand it, the way we do it before Obama land is that all of our taxes would go into a big pot, and then the federal government would dole out some of that money to the hospitals who were basically providing care for people who couldn't pay for it in a form of grants. I think they called them grants. I don't know what they're really granting, but
yeah.
So that's how we pay for people that don't have health insurance, is that we pay them all through taxes.
Right.
And so I think the case for this is we're all doing it this way, and that does not seem to be the most efficient way to do it. And this is where Obama gets his conservative cred from here. Conservative cred, you hear that, Jeremy?
Yeah, I heard it.
Is that he knows that the private insurers may be able to do a better job. So he's not saying you have to buy government health insurance. You just have to buy some health insurance.
Yeah, not this time around.
Right, right, sure. Yeah, maybe that'll all change. But the key matter is wouldn't it be better to buy health insurance for yourself and use that for your money and your own health care rather than having somebody else pay it through taxes?
Yes.
I mean, we could talk forever about whether it will work, what's really going to happen, how the government's going to screw it up. But what I'm trying to get out there is the idea that the concept is not a terrible one.
But you just said, isn't it better to use your own money to buy health care instead of someone else's, right?
Right.
That doesn't change the reality that the same people who can't afford health care right now still won't be able to afford it in 2 years, so it's still going to be paid for through some kind of subsidy.
Right.
So what is the difference?
Well, it's just
you could argue, so yeah, what's the difference? Why don't we pass this anyway? Go ahead.
Well, because I guess the idea is that if there's more people in a pot in the insurance pot, that it's going to be better for... That's a more cost savings way of doing it rather than somebody having no insurance and then cracking his head on when he's riding his motorcycle around and now has $500,000 of bills that we have to pay. Maybe it's not.
Worked for Social Security. Why would we expect this to work for healthcare?
Well, I want to go back to something Rob said just a second ago about this not being terrible. It's not, as long as you believe that, you know, the taxation that's required to make the whole thing work is not terrible.
Right.
It's no more terrible, I'll give you that, but, you know, the taxation itself is evil, and therefore everything that gets paid for with the tax money is evil. And this is just a different distribution method, but to me it doesn't make it any more acceptable or less offensive.
Right, right. And for me, on the other side, I'm completely sensitive to the fact that it seems distasteful to be forced to purchase something.
Yes.
Even if it's good for you. But I mean, is that any worse than being forced to pay taxes into a big pot?
No.
You know.
No. Right. I mean, if you've resigned yourself to that being okay, then yeah, I can see why this is no big deal. This is not a huge leap from there. It's just... And since you brought it up, I think the commentary I've been reading today has said that, you know, John Roberts' opinion that he wrote calls that out specifically about the what was the point you just made? Oh, about forcing people to buy stuff.
Right.
It makes the point that no, the government cannot force you to buy anything. and that's not, in fact, what they're doing. This is a tax.
Right, right.
And, you know, I've already seen some of the punditry out there about that nuance, you know, that Roberts has actually dealt the Republicans did them a huge favor by phrasing it that way, because now this whole thing can be framed as, you know, the Democrats are raising taxes again.
Right.
Well, and right. It's also unconstitutional for the judicial branch to levy taxes. And that's not how the original healthcare, I want to call it the Affordable Care Act. I don't want to call it the Obamacare.
Nice.
I
want to
call it Obamacare, all right? But it was originally written not as a tax, and for the judicial branch to characterize it as a tax, they can't do that.
Well, I think from the short bit that I read today, the majority opinion basically said, if you don't call this a tax, it's unconstitutional.
Right. That's what I heard.
It will not pass muster any other way unless it's a tax, because that's the only power that Congress has.
Yes, but if the judicial branch is calling it a tax, they can't do that. Taxes have to originate in Congress.
Well, the thing I actually read some of the decision.
And let me clarify. That's the minority opinion. If you read their statement, they say that.
They say what?
That it's unconstitutional for the judicial branch to reframe this as a tax.
No, okay. Well, I think that's a silly reading. Take that, Scalia. I think I'm way more of a constitutional scholar than that dude.
Yeah, no doubt.
Like I read like about 2 pages of that decision. That's about as much legalese I've ever read. But no, I think what the Roberts part was that it seemed like he made the case that if a law is passed and it's challenged for constitutionality, then it's not sufficient to just find for the court to find, you know, one test that doesn't pass and then throw the whole thing out. That the responsibility of the court is to try to find a way that it would be constitutional to kind of defer to Congress that way. If there's no way, yes, you want me to fire it up? So
you can fire it up, but that's not
because that's what he said. He basically said, you know, the decision said, well, it can't be passed by through the Commerce Clause. And it can't be passed by with this. So the only way it could be considered constitutional is that it's a tax. So it's not the judicial branch levying the tax. That's what they determined made it possible and constitutional.
But that's not the way the law was written.
Well, what do you mean? I mean, you mean that wasn't their intent?
Yes, they don't. They specifically said this is not a tax.
Right.
Well, they're wrong.
So they don't know what they wrote. They surely don't. I will agree with that.
Well, I think you're right. You're right. They didn't frame it as a tax, but I don't think the court's job is to listen to the political punditry. I think their job is to look at the law itself. I mean,
they did, and the law calls this mandate. If you don't follow the mandate, it calls it a penalty.
Right, paid through the IRS.
Wow, what's the difference? I mean, really, that's really just semantics, isn't it? I mean, anytime the government takes your money by force, it's a tax. I mean,
right. A penalty and a tax.
Call it an impost, call it a fee, call it a penalty, call it a fine, whatever you want to call it, it's a tax.
Right.
Isn't it?
Right.
The Supreme Court dissenting opinion disagrees with that.
Right. So, yeah. Where were we? I don't know.
I refuse to recognize the authority of the court, so there you go.
Well, yeah, and I've seen they say, well, you can refuse to pay the penalty / tax.
You
if
can?
If you don't, yes. Well, but then the IRS is going to come after you, just like they would if you don't pay your taxes.
Okay, well, there you go. Even more evidence that it's a tax. If the IRS is the one enforcing it.
Yeah, see, it's a tax. You're right, and it doesn't really matter.
No, in the grand scheme, it doesn't. It's, you know, it fails on multiple grounds long before you get to the discussion of whether it's a tax or not.
Right.
In my opinion.
Yeah, and I wish, I guess, again, in my dreams of a more level-headed conservative opposition, like I wish the discussion was more about whether this would even work at all. Like, whether it even makes sense, whether it can even have a possible chance of succeeding. Or if you really want to pull on the middle class, office workers of the large corporations of the world, you know, they could just play it out and say, look, if you have a government run insurance exchange, that's going to be cheaper than the private one because they're, you know, if you want to make that claim. So why wouldn't your corporation just sell off their Blue Cross Blue Shield and go to the exchange? And then everybody's in the exchange and now you have exactly what you didn't want. You know, all these arguments, but you know, again, maybe I'm just not at the right sites or I don't hear the right things, but I didn't hear those arguments and I still don't hear those arguments. I hear tea parties and tri-cornered hats getting all crazy. You know, or I hear, you know, this is socialism, or I hear death panels, or I mean, how about just this ain't gonna work? And I think that's the good thing about this decision.
I think a lot of people have said this isn't gonna work and it was passed anyway.
How so? In what ways do you think it's not gonna work?
Well, show me something the government's in charge of that does work and is efficient.
Well, that's I don't know how compelling that is. I mean, I agree with you.
I think it's very compelling.
But you could say the government's not really doing anything. They're just saying, we want to be out of this. We want to stop taking your money, throwing it in a pot, and giving it back to you. You guys buy your own insurance, so we don't have to do this anymore.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, which is what the thing's doing. Stop giving us this taxes so we can throw them in a big pool and then decide to throw them out to your hospital when Johnny, your neighbor, just bangs his head on the concrete. Why don't you just make Johnny get his own insurance so we can stop doing this? Sounds conservative.
What if Johnny can't afford his own insurance? This expands Medicaid.
Well, right. What about the millions of Americans that don't have health insurance right now simply because they don't think they need it? You know,
what about Christian Scientists?
They're young, they're healthy, they don't want to spend the money on that. They have, you know, they have iPods to buy and cars to, this same argument came up in 93 when Hillary was trying to do the same thing. It was like, you know, 11 million people or whatever don't have health insurance. Okay, well, let's break that number down. Half of those are people aged 18 to 29 who don't need health insurance, and they got better things to spend their money on. The same thing is true today.
Yeah, but
probably twice as many people now.
Yeah, but when that dude gets sick, who's paying? I mean, do we just destroy his entire income and make him sell his apartment and all his family's cash?
That can
no.
happen whether you have insurance or not.
Yeah. It can, but that's not what we do. That's not what we do.
That's not what we do?
That's not what happens. That's not what happens. The guy goes to the hospital, say he gets the viral meningitis or whatever it is.
Then the problem is the law that forces the hospital to provide him care when he walks in the ER with a nosebleed.
But see, I don't know. I think if we talk to some doctors, they would say they'd do that anyway, even if there wasn't a law.
Okay, well, fine. But then they're paying for it. It's not being funded by the government through grants that are, you know, ultimately coming from tax money. It's coming from charity. It's coming from, you know, benefactors of the hospital who want to, you know, do good things for their community or whatever. But it's not coming out of the tax money pool. See, that's the key, I think. And I started to say this earlier when we were talking about the food analogy. The analogy would be the same if restaurants had a law forcing them to feed starving people who show up that have no money.
I'd be down with that.
I mean, you know.
I'm just kidding.
If there was some way to prove you were starving, you walk into a restaurant and say, I don't have any money, I'm starving, feed me. Well, the restaurants are going to turn around to the government who passed this law, forcing them to do this, and say, hey, pay up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't fault them for that. I think that's the logical thing to do. But the problem, the fundamental problem, is that law, or that whole class of laws that, you know, that we've passed in an attempt to cover all of the people who can't afford to cover themselves.
That's right. That's right. And or maybe just at some point we all just got soft and we decided that we needed to help people with meningitis and nosebleeds.
Okay. Well, the question for me then is, who is responsible for those people, ultimately? Who has the responsibility to take care of them?
Everyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you believe in the collective and believe in, you know, but that's why you get slapped with the socialism label, right?
Right, right.
That's where it comes from.
Now, right, because we're all in charge of everybody else.
You're in charge of everybody else?
No, I wouldn't say in charge, but
you
but,
did just say in charge.
Well, what I meant was responsible for, to answer Jerry's question.
Yeah.
You know, who's
Freudian slip?
Not in charge, but who's responsible for that person? I wish it was them, but when it's not, it's me.
Which I agree with up to a point, because, you know, I feel that sense of moral obligation to help people less fortunate than myself. I understand that, but I will not go so far as to legislate that. It has to remain voluntary.
Right.
Or it's not charity.
Charity by gunpoint.
It's larceny. It's charity at gunpoint. You're right. That's exactly what it is.
So what other reasons is it not going to work, Jeremy, other than the fact the government can't do anything except send dudes to space and figure out things?
I didn't say they can't do that, but they're not necessarily efficient or cost-effective or timely at doing that.
But can't you read the law and say, well, they don't really want to be doing it. They want you to buy whatever insurance you want to buy.
Well,
you think that's all kind of a lie and a ruse? And then you go, oh, look, you can't buy it. Look, how about this government-run thing? Yay, single payer, we win.
I think the whole thing is a lie and a ruse.
That's the spoonful of sugar to get the medicine to go down. That's all that is.
Right, because it does come down to, well, what are you going to do with the people who can't pay? Well, you're going to provide them, you know, some kind of low-cost taxpayer-funded thing, which then everybody's going to want to be in the low-cost taxpayer-funded thing because they're going to think everybody else is the taxpayer.
Right.
And now how's State Farm going to make a profit
when
the other one's subsidized? There, I just skewered this thing better than all you Fox News cats. Hire me on. I'll be Alan Colmes.
That's the problem with socialism, right? Eventually, you run out of other people's money.
That's true.
And I'm not taking credit for that quote. I think that was Margaret Thatcher who said that.
Good lady there.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, what?
She's kind of hot, too.
Oh, man.
Oh, you know there's some conservatives out there that... That's right up their alley. Nice iron lady. Yes.
Wow.
Not really my thing. I'm more of a Hillary.
So, okay. Going back to what I said earlier about, you know, the hidden agenda here, do you think there is, this is just the first move in a series of moves that takes us to, you know, free food for everybody, free housing for everybody?
Are you asking me?
Anybody.
Go ahead.
I don't know if I see the free housing, but it Rob, get your scoff voice ready.
All right, I'm ready.
Scoff sound ready. But it does feel like the initial step in some kind of greater plan. Yes.
I'll buy that. I could see how it would seem. I didn't scoff. But I do think we're on a much slower pace than is billed to be in panic mode. I mean, look how I think this was a pretty moderate step. If it's a large step, but it's certainly, you know, I think it can be seen as being pretty a pretty small step. You can ask your Republican candidate for.
You just said three different things. A moderate, large, small step.
It is all those things.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
I think for me, especially if you're a single payer person, which I'm not, this looks like small potatoes. It's like a little tiny inch forward. You know, if you're Glenn Beck, you think it's the beginning of the end, and it's, you know, it's socialism in action. I mean. What I think is that it seems like a pretty moderate step forward, what I call forward, in a certain direction. And look at the ruckus it's causing. half of it got struck down as unconstitutional. It's going to, Obama's got to battle it all throughout this next election cycle. Like, I can't say it's like, hey, let's pass this, and everybody's wee, and on we go. I mean, there's plenty of resistance. You know, I don't see that. You know, it's not 80% of the people on board, and let's go farther. And the bill is the way it is because it's the only thing that could pass, and that's with 60 senators of a single party in the House. And I don't mean like the House of Representatives. I mean like in the House.
Yeah.
So until that all happens again, I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of anything. But I'm sensitive to the argument that it's the old slippery slope.
So here's a question. Why did it work this time and not 20 years ago when the Clintons were at the helm?
You know, I don't know.
Have we changed as a nation and this is just more acceptable to us now? Or did Hillary just really fumble the ball back then and they should have gotten this done 20 years ago?
I think Hillary, I don't remember, I was pretty young back then, but I think they were trying to do something. They were trying to figure things out before they passed it, and that's where they screwed up.
I agree.
Yeah, you're right. There was some pretty exhaustive research done then.
And this was just, let's write this huge thing, run it through, and figure it out later.
Yeah.
And
no.
I'm not trying to pick on sound bites. I'm serious.
Right. And for me, I don't think it was. You got the two approaches. You got the Clinton approach where they would get together with all their smarty pants people and craft the magical way it would happen, and then they'd try to sell it to Congress. And that's why it died. Nobody was feeling that. This is the other way. All right, Congress, you crazy bunch of dudes and dudettes, you figure this thing out. And that's why it became such a nightmare as far as messaging and as far as what was in the bill and who's trying what and Bart Stupak coming through there and derailing it, because that's the way Congress works. But I think because it was allowed to go like that is how it got passed. So that's the genius of letting that situation play itself out, is because I think supposedly the lesson of the Clinton years is that that's the only way it'll get done. That you have to give all the crazy Congress critters the idea that they had a hand in it.
Yeah.
Even if they're all on your side. And that's why the bill is such a mess, because you got, I mean, it's by committee and by everybody, every state and their own little exemption, and all the nasty stuff that happened through that whole thing is because it was Congress working that out. If it was mandated by the executive branch, there wouldn't be any Cornhusker kickback or whatever it was.
And you think that's okay? I mean, you called that genius.
It's genius.
I call that a mockery of the way our government is supposed to work.
Well, it's genius tactically, is what I'm saying.
Well, the reason I asked my question is, you know, you made the point that this was, depending on your point of view, either a small, moderate, or large step. I'm just wondering, did it fail in 93 because it was too large a step then for most people to swallow, and today it's not?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the country's about in the same place. I mean, I do think there's a lot less trust in employers. I think that's a big thing. I think that's something that kind of sort of gets lost in this whole discussion, is this might be the first step into divorcing the relationship between your employer and your healthcare provider.
Yeah.
You know, so I think people working for large Fortune 500 companies aren't, and especially younger workers, they don't feel, I don't think the companies feel as loyal to their employees, and the employees don't feel as loyal to their company. So why are they tied up into who my doctor is?
Yeah. Well, that's never been a terribly healthy relationship, pardon the pun, to begin with. You know, it had its genesis in companies trying to get around the income tax and get around other laws that,
right.
that Congress had already passed. So the idea was attract the best talent by providing them health care you can do without, you know, raising their salaries.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that history. That's as I understand it as well. But I don't think people have really changed in the 20 years. I think when the general public starts discussing this idea of individual mandates and starts thinking about, hey, how do we pay how do these people without health care get their health care now? Do they just not get any health care? Wait, they still get health care. Well, how do they do it? Oh, we're all paying. Well, what's a better way for us all to pay? I think as that sequence starts playing out in people's minds, I think you're going to see the whole thing be more popular than because people are going to forget about Cornhusker kickbacks and Bart Stupak. I'm surprised I remember that dude's name.
I've already Bart Stupak. About him.
He's not in the Congress anymore, is he?
I think so.
I think that was his last hurrah. It's genius, Jeremy.
It's criminal. And I'm not against helping people who need health care. But the way they're going about this is, I don't like it at all. I don't like the deception. And strangely, I think back in 93, the country was probably in a better position to pay for all of this than it is now.
Yeah, right. That's the ironic part.
But Rob and Jerry, both of you, you have children. How do you feel about vaccinations? This goes back to the question of, is this the first step in something more, something greater?
I'm fine with vaccinations.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, I'm okay with the fact that they exist. I mean, are you mandatory vaccinations?
Yes. Did you have? Because I know there's a non-trivial movement of parents who don't get all the normal vaccinations for their children because of. I mean, some of it was related to studies that said, "Oh, it contributes to autism or this and that."
Right. Well. You know, I will say this. I don't think, you know, obviously, I don't think any of it should be mandatory.
So, okay. Well, but that's where I see this going.
But the context is usually, you know, a school refusing entry of your child because they haven't had their immunizations.
Right.
And, you know, I find that especially objectionable.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you feel like... Like the vaccinations are harmful, or you just feel like it's over the top in forcing people to do things to their bodies?
I think we don't know. I think there's a lot of people who say we know, but I'm not convinced that we know whether or not all vaccinations are harmless in that, you know, that regard. So, I mean, there is a certain amount, you know, with the first time we took my oldest to get shots, I had that discussion with his pediatrician about the Marisol and all the other ingredients, that preservatives and whatnot that are in these shots. And, you know, I respect my pediatrician's opinion, and he said he didn't think there was anything to worry about, that, you know, he follows that pretty closely. He reads the literature and all that. But see, that's my decision, right? It should not be anybody else's decision, ever. And that's the problem. That's what I find objectionable about it. Because it's my child. So, you know, I say, let the parents decide. And
yeah, this is a classic one. Because, I mean, I think the only way you eradicate polio is you vaccinate everybody so that the polio can't survive, or tuberculosis, or whatever it is.
Right.
That I think if you just, you know, hand it out to whoever can pay for it, well, that's not much of a vaccination.
Right.
You know, you're not really doing much to eradicate any diseases. So it's a great example. It's goals of the collective versus the rights of the individual.
Yeah.
Common theme on the process.
Yep. That might be something we spend some more time exploring later, because it's an interesting topic all by itself.
Well, right. And I will say that there, you know, one thing that's frustrating for me is I think I'm sounds like, just by the way you described it, Jerry, that you asked your doctor, you probably looked up some things, you made an informed decision, and you did whatever you thought was best. That's all great. But I don't really... I quibble with the just the classic kind of conspiracy theorists or the bash the government types that just say, well, I'm just not going to do it because the government wants me to, you know, because that's I don't find that a good reason.
Right, because that's how they control your mind.
Right, right.
So it's a better reason to say, well, I will do it because the government wants me to?
Well, I think you're doing it for what you think is right for your kid and right for everybody else around you.
Why? I take exception to that. Why, if you do it, you're saying, well, you did it because that was the right thing to do and it's for your child. But if you don't do it, well, it's just because of the government.
No,
It's a big F you to the government.
No, I'm saying if that's the only reason to not do it, that's not a very good reason.
Okay, well, in the same vein, if the only reason to do it is because the government says, then that's just as bad.
Well, right, sure. Sure, I mean, you have to think about, hey, what's really going on here? And if you're comfortable with it, you should go ahead and do it. Or if you're not comfortable with it, then you don't do it. But just to F you the government is not a good plan for me.
I agree with you that people who, you know, make their decision just gainsaying whatever the government says is not a good approach. If you haven't done the research and come to your own informed decision, then you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
Right. It does fold in nicely with Eric's topic that it keeps coming up in my head about when we trust science. You know, they came out, I'm sure Jeremy knows, I heard on the news, that possible hidden ocean on Titan. I had to ask myself if I cared. Don't really care.
I do. I care.
Jeremy cares. But we're like you hear that on the radio and we trust that. We think, hey, there's guys with some crazy telescopes figuring stuff out. You know, but when it comes down to global warming or vaccinations, you know, suddenly we don't trust doctors or scientists. Like, why are there some bits of science that we trust and others that we don't?
That qualitative versus quantitative. It's like, yes, I can tell there's an ocean there, or there's a large body of something there. But you don't know what that body of water or body of something is going to do. If you predict, well, that is going to grow by 40% over the next century because the sun is going to spew out more particles and blah, 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 whatever else, well, then I'm going to start questioning that.
Yeah, well, the ocean on Titan might not be a good example, but it does illustrate that, you know, there are certain science topics that have direct impact on us in our daily lives, and then there are others that are just, you know, the answers to trivia question. And that, to me, is one of the main kind of subdivisions of those issues. Like, you know, global warming, the changes that you know are being proposed have direct impact on me on a day-to-day basis,
right?
You know, so I'm gonna be engaged when you start talking about that topic. Whether I'm informed or not is, you know, kind of a side issue, but I'm gonna be engaged on that one. When you start talking about the oceans on Titan, I couldn't give a rat's butt about the oceans on Titan, and it has impact on me. So, you know, that debate is not, I'm not going to be engaged on that topic. So wow. I think that's one of the primary kind of qualifiers.
But if global warming gets carried away, then, you know, it really gets out of hand, then that ocean on Titan might be our only refuge, Jerry.
It's going to look tasty here a little bit.
Yeah, right, because we can all drink methane.
I excrete it. Why can't I drink?
All right, happy note. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some listener feedback and then cover a handful of these links we've been collecting here over the last couple of weeks. So stay with us. We're back. We have some feedback from listener Eric about our our last episode, he made the comment, "Nice to hear Nathan."
Yay.
Yay. Yeah, we enjoyed having Nathan on the show. That was good. He says, "By the way, Jerry, I actually enjoyed that TED talk. I thought it was pretty well done. I listened to it last week, so my memory may be faulty, but I didn't consider it quite as pro-liberal as you guys did. I thought he made a decent case that you need both for a well-functioning society."
No, I think his memory is faulty.
Yeah, I mean, I completely could sense the, you know, the pro-liberal bias in that talk. But, you know, I thought that was kind of the point, actually, of, you know, what he was saying. That, you know, liberals are more open-minded, and it's that open-mindedness that's going to save us. That was the message, in a nutshell.
What a douche.
But I also agree with Eric's comment here that you need both for a well-functioning society. I think that's right. I mean, if you're going to have any sort of rigorous debate about any given topic, you got to have people on every side of an issue. Not necessarily two sides. There might be more, but
I agree with that too. But when one side thinks, "Well, I am right,"
yeah,
that's when you have problems.
Yeah.
I think I have a different opinion, and obviously other people, but mine's not necessarily more right than somebody else's. And this guy thought he was right,
yeah,
in my opinion, in my incorrect opinion.
Eric goes on to say, "Whoa, the video about how little history, geography the high school kids know has been removed by the person who uploaded it." Yeah, I noticed that after we published it. He says, "Sort of a teenage jaywalking sketch, though, right? Obviously, they only picked the ones that missed the questions, and with kids like that, I wonder if the whole thing is a setup. I don't doubt that there are kids who don't know these things, but there's plenty of adults that don't either. I really doubt this is a recent phenomenon. And did you know that IQ score steadily rose throughout the 20th century?" And he provides a link to something called the Flynn effect. So I'll have that in the show notes. To me, it wasn't the number of students or even the notion that they all got it wrong. It was just the fact that there are some students coming out of our school system that don't know the answer to these questions, and they are very simple questions. That's the, you know, the shocking or astonishing part of it. You know, it's been a long time since I've had a civics class, right? But I know who the president and vice president and speaker of the house, and, you know, I know who those people are. And these kids have just had the civics class, maybe even earlier that day. They don't know who the vice president is. So to me, that's the point. You know, it's not that they can't name every country on earth that begins with U, because that was one of the questions.
Uganda.
Uruguay. United States.
United Arab Emirates. United Kingdom.
Uzbekistan. Ooh, I totally win.
It's not that they can't name all of them. It's that some of them said Utah.
Right, yeah.
That's so, I appreciate what Eric said. I think he kind of missed the point of the video, and part of that, of course, is because he couldn't watch the video, but I'm just trying to illuminate that. So he says, to Jeremy's comment about the death spiral of civilization due to lack of shame and ignorance, "While I consider myself conservative, this touches on the biggest problem I have with the leadership of the Republican Party right now. If a candidate expressed their acceptance of global warming or evolution, I don't think they'd get the nomination. There seems to be a glorification of distancing yourself from the, quote, elitist college-educated liberals," unquote.
Let me start off by saying, yeah, if a candidate expressed acceptance of global warming, I certainly wouldn't nominate them because that's a bunch of BS. So, but
Stir the pot, Jeremy. Just stir the pot.
I think those are two issues that are a little bit... They are fence busters. So maybe that's not quite the best example. I'm not sure. The second one plays into religion a little bit too much, so it's kind of a gray area. But I get the point, and I don't know if it's distancing, if that helps to distance yourself from college-educated liberals, but maybe.
Yeah, I don't know what Rob's feeling is on this. I think we've touched on this actually on the show before and talked about how, you know, Fox News makes a big deal about the elitist liberals who, you know things. You don't need to know anything. You just need to, you know, you just need to believe what we're telling you. I agree that that's a problem. And I, you know, I point the finger at Fox News first and foremost on that, because they seem to lead the way in glorifying the being ignorant, you know. Like, you don't need to know that.
It's comforting, like I said. It's like soothing music. The point of Fox News is to soothe the inner soul. You know, that's the same why watching the McLear News Hour is unsoothing. It's like all this information and then all these words. Show me a pretty picture of graph going up, graph go down.
There's a Chris bit where he's talking about that.
A what bit?
A Chris Rock bit.
Oh, Chris Rock, yeah.
Where he's talking about, I'm trying to remember now, he says something about, they're asking some guy, you know, what's the capital of Zimbabwe? He's like, I don't know that. I'm keeping it real. you know.
I do remember that now. Real dumb. Yep.
What else we got?
We collected quite a few links since the last episode, since we took a week off. So I'll be putting those in the reading room there for anybody who wants to check that out. I don't know if there are any in there you want to talk about specifically. Jeremy, you had one.
Yeah, the one about NBC editing a Romney speech. I don't remember the context of it now, but there have been at least a handful of incidents lately. It kind of came to light with the Trayvon Martin shooting, and then here again with this Mitt Romney speech, that NBC has done some editing of these things and not disclosed that when they've aired whatever the video clip or audio clip happens to be, and it very much changes the meaning of it or the context of it or the impression that's given.
Right.
And this is not reporting news. This is manufacturing a position,
right?
And it's dishonest. And no, so far, I don't think anybody's been taken to task for this. I'm kind of curious why, because anytime something else seems to happen, it's, well, we're going to get to the bottom of this and find out who's responsible and blah blah blah. And
yeah, I think I know what speech you're talking about. He was talking about a sub shop or something, wasn't he?
Yes, that's what it was. That's what it was. And they were trying to make it sound like he was out of touch because he didn't know. He was fascinated by how a sub sandwich was made at Subway or something like that. Or like the credit card machine or something. It was not what he was saying. The point of what he was saying was they have this efficient operation and government doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And why doesn't it?
Right.
Which is a very valid point.
Yeah.
It's hacked up by NBC.
When I saw that story, it was accompanied by, like, the raw video of him at the rally that, mm-hmm. One of the people in the audience had made. And to me, the striking thing about it was he starts his story off asking the crowd if they eat it at Wawa's or whatever the name of the place was. And there's like no response. There's just crickets. You know, it's like he picked the name of some local establishment that nobody'd ever heard of. And apparently nobody goes to. That was, I thought was funny. It was like, come on, can't somebody on the campaign, you know, don't you have an advanced team that could figure out where the popular spots are to go?
Right.
To locals?
Just go scout out the lunch crowd and don't pick the empty place.
Right, right.
Well, speaking of, I just have to throw this in, you know, to get a barb in on Obama, but apparently he congratulated the Miami Heats on their victory.
Come on, I saw that too. That was a classic drudge. But come on, there hasn't been a... Why do you find that so funny? Come on, there hasn't been a more basketball-in-tune president in the entire history.
Exactly, and that's
I mean, you
could
get
funny.
It's just a misstep. It's not like he's out of touch with basketball.
Well, but they made such a big deal about his NCAA tournament bracket, and you know, he tries to be the cool president, and then he's the Miami Heat.
He only follows college ball. He doesn't follow.
I'm glad this gives you such pleasure.
I wonder if he'll say the Chicago Bull.
He's a big fan of the White Sox.
You brought up Trayvon Martin, and there's a couple of links in there about the links. But the one, and I don't think I put a link to it, but the one I caught the other day, and we talked about this a couple episodes ago about Zimmerman being described by CNN as a white Hispanic. Well, the latest incarnation is white and Hispanic. So yeah, I don't really understand what's going on there. Either somebody at CNN, some editor at CNN needs to be fired, or yeah.
He's white and Hispanic, but he was out in the sun today, so he's a little bit brown and
yeah. So the police chief down there in Sanford, Florida, was fired as a result of the whole case. He's apparently being made a scapegoat in how the police handled it. That's one of the links I put in there.
I saw that and I heard about it. I didn't read the whole story, but it was kind of interesting to me that he's been fired. I don't... What wrongdoing did they find? They just said, hey, we need to fire you because it's the thing to do.
Right.
I think the general botching of the sensitivity of the case, I think. You know, I think...
But what did they botch, though?
Well, I think he was just too quick to just go, yep, looks like self-defense, off you go. You know, I think as the case comes out, it's going to be at least up for debate, you know. And so probably that's probably the biggest issue there is just, I mean, Zimmerman was free and clear for a couple of weeks, right? Before it all came out in the media.
Yeah.
So seemed like a little bit too quick to dismiss.
But didn't they go back to the scene of the crime and have him reenact what happened?
Yeah, like the next day.
Yeah.
And
so they did it wasn't trivial what they did to investigate this.
Yeah, maybe they should have done more, who knows. But yeah, but I do think they definitely are going to go head hunting for somebody. And I like the thing I enjoy about the whole Trayvon Martin story is just the way like these random things can happen in a course of a life. Like this guy, this police chief was probably, you know, he was probably some kind of, you know, foot policeman on some other beat and ended up, you know, kind of rising through the ranks and found a promotion. Oh yeah, you know, I think I'll move to Sanford. They're going to give me this chief job. Sweet, you know, and he in his little community and has high hopes. And then this thing happens.
Yeah.
And same thing with Zimmerman. You know, I'm sure he thought he was going to go do his neighborhood watch duty and yeah, I'll pack my gat just in case and he didn't think he'd end up here.
I certainly didn't think I'd end up here. So, I guess it happens to everybody.
That's right. What was expected to be here. One other thing I wanted to highlight here, I put a link to a documentary about the marijuana industry in the United States. And it's a full-length documentary. It's on YouTube. You can watch it for free. It's pretty interesting. It's called The Union. And the union refers to all the people that work in the industry. Like once you've been in it a while and you've specialized in something, they refer to, even though it's not technically a union, they refer to it as a union of, you know, people who are experts in, I don't know. There's apparently some expertise required to trim marijuana plants and, you know.
Rob, you're a liberal. What's the expertise required?
I'm clean.
I watched a fair amount of that tonight, and unlike marijuana, the video was quite addicting. I needed to get up and do something else, and I kept putting it off and putting it off to watch the video. It was pretty good.
Yeah, it is good. I'd recommend it to and all of our listeners.
It's maddening if you take what's in this video, and I don't have a great reason to believe they didn't. It didn't seem like they were distorting facts. You know, usually you can kind of tell, but it's maddening why this is illegal.
Yeah. And I guess I should point out, too, that the guy who made the film is Canadian, and the film kind of centers on the marijuana industry in British Columbia, but, you know, they talk quite a bit about how much of an influence the U.S. market has on what they do. So it's not strictly about the U.S. It's just about, I guess, all of North America, really.
Interestingly enough, the union kind of ties back to the teenage jaywalking story. They're interviewing a young couple on there, and they say something about British Columbia Bud, or BC Bud, they call it,
yeah,
which is marijuana from British Columbia. And the guy asks the girl, where is British Columbia?
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know, Britain? I think it's in Britain. Her boyfriend goes, no, it's in Canada.
Yeah. Those man on the street interviews are always entertaining.
Yes, they are.
Last link I'll mention, our listener Nathan provided a link to an essay. It's a few years old. It's called The Wrongful Conviction of Martha Stewart. So this was written shortly after she was convicted. But it came up in a discussion. Roger Clemens, his whole case was being framed as a drug case, right? It was all about the drugs.
Yeah.
But, you know, in reality, he was on trial for perjuring himself, and it would only have been about drugs had he been found guilty. But since he was acquitted, then that means he didn't lie, which means he didn't take the drugs, which means it wasn't about drugs. But, you know, every time that story was reported, it was all about the drugs. Anyway, that got us talking about Martha Stewart, because she was also convicted of lying to, you know, federal investigators. She was not convicted of securities fraud or insider trading or any of that stuff that, you know, that, but that's all you ever heard in connection with that story. So this kind of, you know, links in with what we were saying before about the media, about NBC editing the story.
Yeah.
The stories are portrayed in a certain way, and unless you dig a little bit deeper, you may not, you know, find the truth about them.
On a personal note, Roger Clemens is a complete tool, and I don't believe anything he says.
Okay, fair enough.
Agree.
Not the least of which was him blaming his wife. What a low-class move that was. Holy cow.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that's all we got, so I will thank our listeners for tuning in once again. We appreciate it. And send us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down. Medicine go down. Just a spoonful. Full of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.